All right, let's turn to Galatians chapter 3. And I'm just going to read the last few verses of Galatians 3, beginning with verse 26. For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Now, we have taken this as sort of an opportunity to discuss the issue of slavery and its history. And when we broke off to take some time off, we were in the middle of talking about this, and it arrived at the point of discussing slavery in the U.S., or actually in the territory of the United States, because we also want to talk about slavery in this whole area before the U.S. became the U.S. And I have to say that... excuse me. That there's so much interesting material that it's hard to know what to include and what to leave out. And unfortunately, my memory is not as good as it used to be, so I can't even remember all the things that I read that are just fascinating. One thing that I stumbled on today and have not had time to check it out and be absolutely sure that it's true. But one person was writing, and he pointed out that African Americans have deeper family roots in the United States than most white people do. And the reasons he gave make sense, because the slave trade was abolished by Act of Congress in 1807. That's 202 years ago. So virtually all of the African Americans in the U.S. derive from people who were here prior to 1807. But the vast majority of white people came from waves of immigration that came after 1807. Now that's kind of an astounding thing, isn't it? But something I'd never thought about. Now, in talking about slavery in the United States, I want us first of all to remember the distinction between slavery and racism. This is a very important distinction, and it's a distinction that is very easy to lose and to forget about, because when we think of slavery, we are accustomed to think of a slavery system in the U.S. that was thoroughly racist. But most of the slavery in the past, speaking of the whole world and going all the way back to ancient times, most of the slavery in the past existed apart from racism. Whites enslaved whites and blacks enslaved blacks. And when they enslaved each other, the concept of race was not used to justify enslavement. The concept of race itself did not even exist prior to about 1600. So there was really no potentiality for racism in the way we think of it today. Now that raises the question of just what is racism? And of course, there are degrees of racism. And we have to think of the fact that all the way back through history, people have considered other groups of people as other. In other words, they're not us. And so, but that's not necessarily racist. In fact, it usually was not racist. The real nitty-gritty of racism, there are a lot of aspects of it, and we're going to get into that later. We're going to have a separate session just on racism. But the real nitty-gritty of racism is that the otherness is considered to be unchangeable. It's tied to race. And the otherness is more than just superficial. And this comes, as I said, in degrees. Think about the Germans and the Jews. Now, the Jews, in a sense, were a separate race, in the sense that they were an ethnic group with a long history. They did take in by proselytization people that didn't have any Semitic heritage, but by and large, they were Semitic. So we could call them a separate race, in a sense. But just being different, or even being inferior, let's say that the Germans were able to prove that the Jews were inferior, that would not be sufficient justification to put them in ovens, would it? I mean, everybody's inferior to somebody else almost. I mean, theoretically, I suppose there may be in the whole world one person who is superior to everybody else in some ways, but it's not going to be superior to everybody else in every way. So we're all inferior to somebody. Just inferiority as a group, if the Jews had been inferior, would not be sufficient to justify Hitler putting them in ovens. There had to be something else, and there was. And Hitler's doctrine was that the Jews were evil. And he had many different aspects to that evil. They had to be eradicated. So they're all degrees of racism. The racism that existed in the U.S. never reached that point of considering black people to be evil, like the Germans did consider the Jews to be evil. That doesn't mean it was justified or that it was not horrible in and of itself. But we're going to talk about racism later. Today we want to focus our attention just upon the slavery that existed in the U.S., but we have to remember that slavery progressively throughout the period of slavery was becoming more and more racist. When it started out, it was not nearly as racist as it was when it ended up. And furthermore, I think that probably it's true that when slavery ended in the U.S. in 1865, there was not as much racism even then as there was to be subsequently in the 1800s and the first part of the 1900s. Now, there are a number of slave systems that existed in the U.S. The first one is that the Indians practiced slavery. Not extensively, but they did. The Northwest Coast Indians, that's Washington State, Oregon, had the most developed and the most extensive form of hereditary slavery, and they treated their slaves, Indian slaves, the most harshly. Indian slaves mostly were captives in war. One tribe would go to war with another tribe, and they would win, and they would enslave their neighbors. By the late 1700s, some members of the Indian nations were enslaving black people, following the example of the white people who were moving into the Indian areas. Now, there was a second slave system that existed in the U.S. from quite early. And that was basically a Spanish slave system. It started in 1526. The site was about 30 miles south of Savannah, Georgia, where the slaves were landed by the Spanish. And Spain governed in various parts of the southern, what is now the southern United States. And they also had an extensive slave community in what is now St. Augustine, Florida. And that was established in 1565. And then, third system, and this is the one that we normally think of as the big slave system. It was really the progenitor or the origin of most of the slavery that existed subsequently in the South. And that was a slavery that began in 1619 in the Chesapeake Bay region, which is Virginia and Maryland, Upper Virginia, Northern Virginia, and Maryland. It was not until the late 1600s that Africans were brought to this area in any large numbers. And it's interesting that overall, less than 100,000 Africans were ever brought to Virginia and Maryland. And by the early 1700s, the population had become self-sustaining. Not only self-sustaining, but it was growing. As a result, by 1780, and this is about the time of the birth of the nation, 1776 being the Declaration of Independence, 1789 being the Constitution, 1780, there were more than 300,000 slaves in the Chesapeake region. At that time, Virginia alone contained almost half of the black population of the United States. And even at the beginning of the Civil War, Virginia still had more slaves than any other state. Now, in this region, slaves worked first in tobacco farming and then in mixed farming. They usually lived on small farms and they lived in close proximity to white people. Typically, it was not gang slaves. It were not big plantations. Tobacco farming was sustainable without slave labor. And it was something that could have been done and was done without slave labor. But nevertheless, there was extensive slave labor used in tobacco farming. So this whole region, because the slave population grew, became the source of most of the slaves that eventually filtered down into the lower South. Now, the year 1626 is the date when there were first slaves brought into the New York area. It was then called the New Netherlands. And the slaves also increased there for about 175 years, so that by the end of the 1700s, New York State contained the largest slave population in the North. And slavery also took root in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and in Delaware. By 1780, again, there's that date which is very close to the founding, right before the Constitution. By 1780, more than 40,000 slaves lived in those four states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, far less than in Virginia. They were mostly farm laborers or domestic servants. And there were also sizable numbers in the cities and towns engaged in not factory work, but like cabinet making and that sort of thing. Now, except in Pennsylvania, slavery died a slow death in this region. At the outbreak of the Civil War, for instance, there were less than 2,000 slaves in Delaware. Delaware was still a slave state before and during the Civil War. And then there was New England, which is above New York State. We go up to Massachusetts to Maine. And slaves arrived here in the early 1630s. But they were never more than just a small fraction of the total population. In fact, in 1780, only 15,000 blacks lived in New England. And most of them were freed over the next two or three decades. And then there was another slave system that developed in the late 1600s in the Lowcountry region of the Carolinas and later in Georgia and eastern Florida. More than half the slaves that were brought to North America in the 1700s and the early 1800s landed in this region. Most of them arrived in Charleston. In fact, Charleston became the only city in America that had more Africans than white people. In 1780, in the lower South, the black population stood at around 210,000. And then there was another slave system in the early 1700s in French Louisiana, centering around New Orleans. This population grew under Spanish rule from about 5,000 in the mid-1760s to 25,000 in about 1800. This was a particularly harsh slave system because of the nature of the work that they did, which was basically sugarcane. The sugarcane plantations of the Caribbean were one of the harshest slave systems that ever existed. And more slaves were brought into the Caribbean than were ever brought into the United States, but they died. They didn't survive. The population was unsustainable because of the harshness of the climate and the harshness of the work that they were assigned to. So a similar situation existed in Louisiana. And the last slave system that we'll look at, which is really the ninth that we've talked about, was the largest, and that was the slave system of the lower South, the southern interior, extending from Carolina through Georgia and Alabama to the Mississippi Delta. And it arose in response to the rising worldwide demand for cotton, and also because of the invention of the cotton gin in 1793. In Alabama and Mississippi, the major growth did not take place until after 1812. At the beginning of the 1800s, about 1 in 10 U.S. slaves lived on cotton plantations. By 1860, that's just 50 or 60 years later, 2 out of 3 lived on cotton plantations. Now, during this time, there was no slave trade. That had been abolished at the beginning of that period. These slaves were coming down from, basically, from Virginia. And they came down along with the white population that populated this whole area. If you look back in the family histories of most white people, they came from the Carolinas. Most white people in Mississippi that have been here for a long time came from the Carolinas. And if you look at the white people in Carolina, where they came from Virginia. So there was this just gradual movement down, and it was in response to the agricultural development of this whole area. Of course, this whole area that we live in now was originally huge forests of gigantic trees, and it was just in a fairly short period of time those trees were felled, and the stumps rooted up, and the land put into production of cotton. Now, the cotton plantations averaged just over 30 slaves each. But, of course, there were many plantations that had many more slaves than that. The cotton farming situation was much more harsh than the situation that the slaves experienced in Virginia, say. And, for instance, in Kentucky and Tennessee, there was a large slave population in Kentucky and Tennessee we hadn't even talked about. But the conditions were not as harsh because the agricultural situation was not as harsh. Now, what about the North? Well, one thing we want to just begin to get into, I see we're running out of time, is that the situation of the African population in the North, because the North gradually began to free slaves. And that happened by individuals just freeing their slaves, and it also happened by law. It was different in each state. The state of New York passed an act in 1799 for the gradual abolition of slaves. Now, how would that work? Well, I'm not sure this was the New York law, but I remember one law provided that all the children of a slave, of any slave mother at the time the act was passed, would become free at the age of 28. So you can see how that is gradual, because the children of the slave mother are going to be slaves until they reach age 28. Well, they're going to be, they're going to be young slave girls who are going to have children during that 28-year period, and their children are going to be slaves until they're 28. So it makes it extend on out, but it is a gradual emancipation of slaves. And the writer that I was reading said that even though this law was passed, in fact, the emancipation happened a whole lot quicker because people just emancipated their slaves. 5 years later, New Jersey emancipated their slaves. And this took place generally throughout the region. An interesting quotation from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The Massachusetts Bay Colony, in its Body of Liberties of 1641, permitted enslavement of lawful captives. Now, this is a quotation. Enslavement of lawful captives taken in just wars and such strangers as willingly sell themselves or are sold to us. End of quote. Now, what does that quotation tell you? Well, it tells me that the people who wrote that law knew that there was a moral problem involved with slavery. And they were trying to hedge it about, even when they were legalizing it and saying that slavery is going to be permitted, they were trying to hedge it about with protections that had some relationship to the slavery that existed in Israel. It was lawful captives taken in just wars, such strangers as willingly sell themselves, and here's the big exception, or are sold to us. Now see, that's the big exception clause, because that opened the door. People outside the Massachusetts Bay Colony could sell to people inside the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and that was just like all the rest of it didn't even matter, because the door is wide open at that point. Now, it makes you wonder how that could be justified. in the minds of those who were writing the law. Because, let's take this illustration. If John Pittman owns a large, beautiful diamond, and my wife steals it from him, and then she turns around and sells it to Sister Julia, Julia, not knowing where it came from, pays my wife $10,000 for it. And then Julia sells it to Sister Mary Ann. Mary Ann, knowing she got it from Julia, but not even knowing where Julia got it. I mean, the law says that if John Pittman sees that diamond in the possession of Mary Ann and is able to identify it, and it can be identified by the flaws that are in all diamonds, doesn't make any difference that Mary Ann didn't know where it came from and paid $10,000 to Sister Julia for it, and that Sister Julia bought it in good faith from my wife, who is the one who really stole it. Mary Ann has to give it up. She has to give it to John Pittman. Now, there is another concept in the law called negotiable instruments. If instead of a diamond, it was $10,000 in cash that my wife stole, then it's a totally different story, because cash is a negotiable instrument. And it cuts off defenses as it's passed. So if my wife takes the $10,000 that she stole and buys an automobile from Sister Julia with the $10,000, Sister Julia's got $10,000, and assuming she didn't know it was stolen money, it's hers. And John Pittman can't get it. You see the concept? And what Massachusetts Bay Colony was doing, and what all the subsequent people in America did, was to apply this negotiable instruments concept to slaves rather than applying the property concept. And it doesn't make sense, because each individual slave is identifiable. They're not fungible. That means that you can't mix them up and go. I mean, one slave is not the same as another slave. They're all individuals, and they're identifiable. And so if one is stolen, then they're still stolen property all the way on down the line. As far as you go, they're still stolen property and should be returnable. But anyway, that's just an insight into the thinking way back in 1641, and an attempt, obviously, to justify and hedge about slavery with protections, but leaving a wide open loophole there. We've already said slavery was much milder in New England, and that was basically because of the climate and the economy and so forth. Pennsylvania had slavery. The Quakers of Pennsylvania, there were warnings that were given by many of the Quaker fathers against it, but nevertheless they admitted it. And during the half century after the Pennsylvania's founding in 1681, a large number of slaves did enter into Pennsylvania. Many of the Quaker elite owned slaves. Now, another thing that happened in the North, and this is interesting because it shows that the whole racism problem was early and happening early, is that freed slaves in the North were not treated as equals. They were, by and large, denied any right to vote. They were usually, in most states, there were laws against intermarriage between blacks and whites. This is in the North. And they were treated as second-class or third-class citizens. And this is freed slaves, people who are now free. So Of course, the same thing happened in the South with freed slaves. They were also treated as second or third class citizens. And then once slavery was totally abolished, after the Civil War, the same thing occurred throughout the South and indeed in the North as well. And that leads us into the whole issue of racism. And you might take a look at these maps. We're going to stop at this point. But I thought the first map shows the numbers of slaves in the various states in 1860 at the time of the outbreak of the Civil War. The second map is not 1860 but 1830, and it shows the relative numbers of free black population in the various states. And you see all down through the South, it's like 1%. Florida, 5% free blacks. But you go up to the states above the southern states, like Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and the number of free blacks relative to other blacks is 100% usually, 99%, 100%. And the question arises, well, why would it not be 100% since these were free states? All these states are free states. Well, the answer, I think, must be, like in Indiana and like 99% in Pennsylvania, is that they had gradual emancipation laws. So at that point in time, in 1830, not all of the slaves had been freed, even though these were classified as free states. They were on the way to being emancipated. Notice the District of Columbia, 50% free blacks, 50% still slaves. Okay, we'll stop at that point.